Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us this morning four Atkinson High School students. Would they please stand?
Wow. Yeah, it's a big
one. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The Fort Atkinson High School students are here with us on a program, which is a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and the State Bar. And under the program, the students are invited to attend an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, they're sent briefs of the case that they're going to listen to, and they may engage in a variety of activities relating to that case. They come to the court, listen to the oral argument, and meet after the oral argument with a justice of this court. And so that's why we're welcome, Fort Atkinson High School students. The discussion right after the this case will be about the procedures the court uses in taking and deciding cases. The discussion will not involve the substantive issues of the case we're about to hear. And everyone is welcome to attend that discussion, including counsel and any other guests we have with us today. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser is the justice with whom you'll meet today. Ordinarily, we meet after a second oral argument at lunch, but there is no second oral argument, so you will meet with Justice Prosser immediately following this argument. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogan-Sack. With those introductory remarks made, we'll call our case for today 05AP2148 KNS Tool and Die Corporation versus Perfection Machinery Sales, Inc. Representing Perfection Machinery Sales is Mr. Gregory P. Siebold. Mr. Siebold.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abramson, Justices. With me today is Mr. Paul Fox of the Greenberg Traurig Firm, co-counsel. May it please the court, I'd like to thank the court for agreeing to review two issues that are incorporated into Wisconsin statute section 100.18 that was part of the dispute between KNS Tool and Die Corporation and Perfection Machinery. Those two issues are: who is a member of the public for purposes of the statute? And there are two sub-issues as part of the second issue. The first sub-issue is reasonable reliance an element of cause under section 100.18? And if so, was there reasonable reliance in this case? I would submit to the court that, as applied to the facts of this case, KNS Tool and Die was not a member of the public, and their reasonable reliance, whether you call it that or material inducement, is an element of causation under section 100.18.
Counselor, I'm sorry, just so I'm clear, are we then not reviewing anything about the jury instructions? Is that not before us?
The propriety of the jury instruction is not before the court. However, as part of my argument, I would suggest that the court can consider the adequacy of the jury instruction in terms of evaluating whether the jury reasonably determined that there was no cause in this case.
Thank you very much.
Let me just clarify that, because when you said, is reasonable reliance an element of cause, I mean, picking up on Justice Rogan-Sack's question, Another way, it seems to me, of framing the question, you can always frame questions small, you can frame them wide. You are, it seems to me, advancing the issue of something like, did the circuit court erroneously instruct the jury on the issue of causation? Isn't that really what you are arguing in a broader sense when you say the issue is reasonable reliance an element of cause, and if reasonable reliance is an element of cause, and if the judge did not instruct the jury with regard to that element of cause, then there's a faulty jury instruction. Am I wrong or am I right? Is that how you slicing and dicing it?
Justice Bradley, I would suggest that the analysis is as follows. First of all, the circuit court gave the standard jury instruction, which talks in terms of a material inducement. Under this court's decision in AIM, moment, Your Honor. I'll give it to you in a second.
No problem.
Here I have it. In Wisconsin v. North Central Airlines, 98 West 2nd 301, and Section 751.06 of the Wisconsin statutes, which allow this court to reverse a decision based upon a miscarriage of justice. In that particular case, even though there was no objection to the jury instruction that was preserved for review, the Supreme Court held that it could review the jury instruction in light of Section 751.06 in determining whether there was a miscarriage of justice. I am suggesting to the Court that the jury instruction, the standard jury instruction, does not adequately inform a jury as to what they need to find in order to find cause. I would suggest to the Court that the terms material inducement are too much legal jingoism and not enough informing the jury about the process that they need to undertake.
Mr. Sebald, were you trial counsel?
I was not, Your Honor.
All right. Did trial counsel for your client request a different instruction or submit a proposed instruction on the issue?
Yes, they did, Justice.
And it was denied.
And it was denied.
Well, what did it relate to a reasonable reliance?
Correct, Justice, Chief Justice, and it did discuss specifically reasonable reliance. I believe that reasonable reliance is a much better descriptor for a jury to understand as a layperson in doing the analysis in a misrepresentation case. And although the Kalin v. Armstrong case makes clear that Section 100.18 is distinct from common law misrepresentation cases, because, for example, intent to sell is the intent requirement under Section 100.18, whereas, for example, in intentional misrepresentation, it would be intent to deceive. However, the cause aspect of Section 100.18 is really akin to common law misrepresentation. And there has to be a connection between the misrepresentation and the decision to purchase. And how can a jury make that determination unless they are able to analyze for themselves the mental process that the purchaser used in order to decide whether to purchase? And that necessarily involves concepts of reliance and reasonableness.
Counselor, I think in Tim Torrey's, the only case that I could find that actually talked about this reliance issue with any specificity, they said actual reliance. They didn't say reasonable reliance. Are you thinking that's the same or different than what you're asking us to do?
Tim Torres did only talk in, it did talk in terms of actual reliance. But they weren't faced with the issue of reasonableness in that particular case, and so I don't think they needed to really go there and determine whether reasonable reliance was an issue. And I would submit to the Court that again, by necessity, it has to be, as in a common law misrepresentation case. Under Section 0.18, you can't simply let a jury rely, for example, on the self-serving statement, I relied on the quotation in this case. Mr. Kluskin testified, I relied on the quotation. Now, if there were no other evidence on the issue of reliance, perhaps it would be sufficient. But when there is other evidence, I think that the jury needs to make the analysis of whether the self-serving testimony is enough, or, in other words, was there reasonable reliance? Did they really rely?
Counsel, I have to confess I'm a bit confused. As I understood this issue with respect to the jury instruction, it was raised at the trial court level. It was raised at the Court of Appeals level. And at our level, you raised your first and third issues. You did not raise this issue.
Right.
So why are we talking about this?
Well, I am discussing it, one, in response to questions.
Right.
He has no choice. From now on, do not answer my questions. Lest you be chastised.
Number two, because I do believe it is it's informative of the issue of reasonable reliance to talk about the instructions, although we are not specifically asking the court to.
You're putting reasonable reliance into causation.
I'm sorry, Chief Justice.
You're putting reasonable reliance into causation.
Who did?
You're saying
you are.
No.
Yeah. Well, that's okay.
I am
part of your sufficiency argument.
Yep.
I'm suggesting that the court should adopt the standard that applies in common law misrepresentation cases in Section 100.18. And the common law misrepresentation cases clearly require reasonable reliance, justifiable reliance.
Let me follow up on my own question and ask it again for Justice Butler's sake.
Thank you, Justice Butler.
No problem. And that is, I don't care what you call it. You might have problems about, I don't know if you have problems about waiver or whatever and not objecting or something to a jury instruction. But when you say and make the argument that it is, I have it written down, but reasonable reliance is an element of cause, as you did at the outset of your presentation. That necessarily implicates the propriety of the jury instruction. Doesn't let me put it in a question. Doesn't that necessarily implicate the propriety of the jury instruction?
I do believe it does, Justice. Again, the circuit court gave the standard instruction, so it's hard to argue that the circuit court erred in giving the standard instruction. But I do believe that the standard instruction is inadequate because it does not adequately instruct the jury of the decision-making process that it should undertake.
The jury instruction is an error of law, and the judge, because it doesn't have the reasonable reliance as an element of cause, and the judge gave a jury instruction that incorrectly stated the law, you can say, oh, I can understand why the judge did this. It's a smart judge. And, you know, he reasonably relied on the jury instructions, you could say. But nevertheless, the judge committed an error of law, and it's, to commit an error of law is an erroneous exercise of discretion. I mean, it's kind of a, you know, the judge is you can understand the error, but that's what you're really saying. You may not want to say it, but that's what you are saying, I think.
Sure. And perhaps to phrase it a different way, the judge gave an erroneous instruction, and the instruction was erroneous by its very text, even though the judge did not author it.
Now, if I'm hearing you right, why do you want the court to read into a statute the common law? This is an old statute, he's 30 to 40 years old. If it's going to be a common law, we don't need a statute. Now, I agree that it's a long statute, defines various types of misrepresentations, et cetera, which common law is case developed. But why should the court read into this statute some words that are not there?
Chief Justice, I would say that the court is not being asked to read something into the statute. What the statute says, 100.18 sub 11 sub B 2, I believe it is any person who suffers pecuniary loss because of a misrepresentation shall be entitled to damages. That's the extent of the discussion of cause in the statute. And so, really, the statute doesn't define cause. It just says because of. And so I think that the court needs to provide guidance on how the statute should be interpreted. To give you a perhaps loose analogy, Section 103.65, the statute that prohibits non-compete covenants in Wisconsin, it doesn't talk about the reasonableness of the geographic scope, the reasonableness of time, the public policy factors. The court has issued decisions that help inform what the statute means and how it should be applied. And that I would submit that that's the same thing that the court should do here.
Well, our decisions have informed it in this sense, as I understand it. The third element of the jury instruction, 2418, deals with cause. In determining whether plaintiff's loss was caused by the representation, the test is whether the plaintiff would have acted in the absence, and then it goes on to use the term, it must have been a material inducement. Sounds to me a lot like reliance, a material inducement. In fact, I think there's case law that says it's the same thing. Material inducement is reliance. So you want to add in reasonable, which is common law.
Justice Bradley, I believe that you're absolutely correct. There's case law that. That says that material inducement means the same thing as reasonable reliance. I would submit to the court that material inducement in the instruction is not helpful at all to a jury.
Let me just pause because you agreed with something I didn't say, and that is case law that says that material inducement is reliance, and then in repeating it, you said, is case law reasonable reliance? There may indeed be, but if you could help me by giving the citation vis-a-vis a case that's interpreting 100.18 that says that.
There is not a case that I am aware of that says that in the context of Section 100.18.
Go ahead.
However, I think that it's quite reasonable to infer and, in fact, conclude that the use of the terms as applied to common law misrepresentation, which is where the discussion takes place, is equally applicable to Section 100.18, because what you're talking about, again, is the connection between a misrepresentation and a decision to purchase. That's the same connection that is made in common law misrepresentation, and it applies equally under Section 100.18.
Well, the only Supreme Court case, and I just want to come around to one of the issues, which is your first issue dealing with 100.18, and it's the automatic merchandiser's case, which talks about deceptive or misleading representation made to members of the public. So I'm trying to, because I know there's limited time here, and I know that we want to get back to your first issue, which is talking about the statute itself, and then weave that into what Justice Bradley is talking about, misrepresentation. But the only case, I'm talking about Supreme Court case that I'm aware of that interprets 118 is it's a 1974 case. I'm sure you're very familiar with it.
I can read it for you.
Sure. And it says the part I was just referring to is that the statute applies to deceptive or misleading representation made to different members of the public. That's the only part I'm referring to. And you're indicating here that K&S is not a member of the public.
Correct.
And they're not a member of the public because they have had former dealings. They had a former dealing with your company or the company you represent in 1996,
and that this was a, quote, solicitation rather than a advertisement. Now, they say, well, we get all kinds of brochures, and we know, because we had dealt with Perfection before, that we could have picked somebody else, but you apparently advertised or had available, or after they called, a 100-ton punch press. Okay? And you're saying that they're not a member of the public because they had, quote, prior dealing, and they had, as I recall, that they solicited. In other words, they called you. You didn't call them.
That's actually not our position, Justice.
That's okay.
That's what opposing counsel would like you to think our position
that's
is.
That's not. Okay. Well, let's say opposing counsel says that. You're saying, no, that's not the case.
That is not the case. It's actually broader than that, and it amounts to this. The prior relationship is informative because there was actually prior business relationship between the parties. They bought a press. There were quotations given periodically. There were periodic catalogs sent to K&S.
And to everybody, and you send them to everybody, right?
And it's true that K&S then came to Perfection and said, do you have a 1,000-ton press? But that's not dispositive. It is part of the overall picture. One thing that is very, very crucial, I believe, that the Court of Appeals did not address, and that is that Mr. Kluskin, the president of K&S, specifically said to Perfection, can you find us a press? And Perfection said, sure, we'll look around, we'll see if we can find you one. And it was after that agreement took place, where they said, can you find us a press? And Perfection said, sure, we'll look around, that Perfection went out at K&S's request and tried to find a press that was not in its own inventory. It started looking around the country, and lo and behold, in the cradle of automobile manufacturing, they found some presses in Michigan. And so then what happened was Perfection got some very brief information from the owner of the press and retransmitted it literally verbatim to K&S in the form of the quotation and said, there's a couple of presses in Michigan. And at that point, K&S took over. And they did all of the investigation themselves. Perfection provided K&S with the telephone number for the manufacturer clearing, and K&S assumed the responsibility to contact the manufacturer. Perfection gave K&S the telephone number of the actual owner of the two presses in question, and K&S assumed the responsibility to contact the owner and find out more.
Did Perfection receive any type of compensation?
Perfection did receive compensation because after K&S hired its own investigators to go to Michigan and personally look at the presses, and K&S independently, based upon all its advisors, made a decision. In fact, K&S's expert said, you should buy that press. And K&S said, okay, we're going to buy that press. When he made that decision, then it came back to Perfection. Perfection was not involved at all in the investigation of the suitability of these presses for K&S's needs.
Mr. Siebold, my understanding, and I've been listening to you describing all of these circumstances, my understanding is that you're making an argument that the circuit court committed error because the circuit court submitted the question of member of the public to the jury. Mm-hmm. And that the circuit court should have, as a matter of law, made the ruling in regard to member of the public. As I listen to all of these circumstances, it strikes me this is really an issue of fact. If I had been sitting on the bench as the trial judge, I certainly would have thought this is an appropriate issue to submit to the jury because it's an issue of fact. Tell me why I'm wrong.
Because even if there is an issue of fact at trial, in some circumstances, the facts are so overwhelmingly compelling of a conclusion in favor of one party, it's the circuit court's duty to take that decision from the jury and give the decision from the court.
And you think the facts are so overwhelming that it was crystal clear that this was a situation that the court could rule as a matter of law?
Yeah, and we're talking about the public issue?
Yes,
in particular?
Absolutely.
Yes, I do, Justice. And the reason is this. The guiding decisions that are out there right now, on the one hand, you have automatic merchandisers, which basically says if a consumer responds to some type of a solicitation and there's a conversation where misrepresentation takes place, that person is a member of the public. Pretty easy decision. On the other end of the bookcase is Kalen v. Armstrong, and it says if you have an explicit written contractual relationship, at that point you're no longer a member of the public. And the question is, where does it fall in between? And it's a facts and circumstances test. That's what automatic merchandiser says.
That sounds like an issue of fact to me, if it's a facts and circumstances test.
It is, but then the facts and circumstances have to be evaluated in terms of what does it mean to say that this party is a member of the public, or to give it to the jury. And what you have in this case is you have a specific request by KNS for Perfection to search out a press on its behalf. And I would submit to the court that if it's found that KNS is a member of the public under those circumstances, what you've essentially done is establish a bright line test that that automatic merchandiser says you don't do. The member of the public line, so to speak, is way over on the Kalen side of the spectrum. And what that would do is it would put a chilling effect on commerce, because sellers would be afraid to say anything to anyone because that person is a member of the public unless they're signing on the dotted line. And you need to evaluate those facts and circumstances. And I think it's a court that appropriately makes that analysis, as opposed to a jury deciding in a jury room whether or not a person is a member of the public, especially given the paucity of guidance.
The case that talks about member of the public most is the manufacturing case that came out of this court, and it talks about a, quote, particularized relationship, looking at old PSC cases. And then there's another case that talks about it in a landlord-tenant context, another one that talks about it in a contracting context, and all of those seem to either be legal relationships or quasi-legal relationships. Do you agree that's the test? And if you do, do you fit it? If you don't think it's the test, why not?
I would suggest that it is not the test.
Okay.
In opposing counsel's brief, they talk in terms of a legally cognizable relationship. I think that is a establishment of a bright line rule.
Okay.
That the court and automatic merchandiser says you don't do. You look at the facts and circumstances. However, in some sense, it's understandable why you would compare it to legally cognizable relationships, if you want to call it that. And I would suggest that in this case, there is a worthy comparison. It's simply an agency relationship. My client was essentially a buyer's agent. They were a finder, and they got their finder's fee.
Was your agreement based on a finder's fee?
No, it was not. And what ultimately happened was, after KNS did all of its investigation, they said, we want that press. They went back to Perfection and said, we want to buy this particular press. And at that point, Perfection was back in the loop. And they went to the owner and said, okay, I'm buying the press that KNS wants, and then they turned around and they sold it to KNS.
Oh, so they bought it first.
Yeah, they bought it and immediately sold it. They would not have bought it if KNS had not said, that's the one we want. And so that's how the fee was obtained. And there's nothing in the record concerning any discussion or agreement of how Perfection would be compensated on the front.
I have one question.
Wilcox?
My question. So there is you have a different relationship with KNS than you would have with the XYZ Corporation, who just looked in your catalog and your brochure. You had a piece of machinery and said, I want that piece of machinery. Do you charge a different, was there a different commission charge? In other words, when you have a piece of machinery in your inventory and you sell it, you know you're going to make a profit because assuming what you're paid for it, you know what you're selling it for. Was this relationship different then?
It certainly was. As you noted, there in the catalogs, they may have a piece of machinery in inventory, and they put a price on it, and that's what they sell it for. In this particular case, when KNS decided they wanted that press, when Perfection found out about the presses, they discussed the purchase of the presses with the owner, And then K&S was put in contact with the owner directly. And as a result of the conversations directly with the owner, K&S found out what Perfection had proposed to pay for the presses and used that information to negotiate a better deal.
What you're saying, this is buyer beware, or this is as is, or whatever. In other words, you had no, you weren't part of that negotiation.
None whatsoever.
Okay. Chief, if I might, Mr. Siebel, just one very quick fact question. On page 13 of your brief, in the first full paragraph, you discuss that although marked as a 1,000-ton press had been converted to an 800-ton press, you cite a couple of record references. When I look at the record references, I do see references to the 800-ton press. I do not see any references to the concept of conversion from 1,000 to an 800. Are you aware if the record reflects anywhere else whether this was a converted press as opposed to just an 800-ton press?
I don't know that the record reflects that there was a conversion. What is clear in the record is that it is labeled as a 1,000-ton press, and it was actually an 800-ton press. Perhaps co-counsel knows if that was done at the outset by clearing so that it was originally manufactured as an 800-ton press, even though it was labeled 1,000 tons, mm-hmm. or whether that there was a subsequent modification.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Siebel. Mr. Hanrahan, representing K&S Tool and Die Corporation.
Hey, please, court. My name is Mike Hanrahan. I represent K&S Tool and Die, who is the plaintiff in this action and the respondent in the case here. This action arose because Perfection Machinery sent a promotional specification sheet that said, we are offering to sell you a 1,000-ton press. Here it is. And, in fact, and it's undisputed, the press that they were offering to sell as a 1,000-ton press was an 800-ton capacity press. The evidence is uncontested that if Perfection had said, we're offering to sell you an 800-ton press, K&S wouldn't have been interested. The evidence also showed that if Perfection had said, here's a press, we don't know what the pressing tonnage is, K&S wouldn't have spent any time to look at it, because they wanted a 1,000-ton press. They needed a 1,000-ton press to make this part for John Deere. They're making this big, taking a big steel sheet, and they stamp it and form it into what becomes like the frame for a John Deere Ryder mower. And so it's a big piece of steel, and they needed a big press, which they didn't have. So they bought this press, believing that it was a 1,000-ton press. They installed it in their plant. When they went to make this particular piece on the first day, they pressed the button, the press came down, and it just stopped. And at that point, K&S knew they had a problem. They investigated. They investigated further. And ultimately, they found out that the press they bought was an 800-ton capacity press, not a 1,000-ton capacity press.
Now, counsel, normally all the facts are decided when they come up here. There's a dispute here between, you know, you heard what opposing counsel indicated. My question is, your first business relationship, you had a prior business relationship, and then you, according to opposing counsel, solicited this business relationship, and then you checked out, I'm just skipping over some of the press, which they did not have in their inventory. Is that erroneous, or?
I believe you have the basic facts. I can give a little more information.
We've read the briefs and we've garnered the facts, but I just, a lot of this, because we're looking at 118, depends upon, you know, whether you are or are not a member of the public.
Exactly.
And that's what we're...
And I think a lot of the discussion that I heard from opposing counsel in his presentation in regard to this member of public issue had to do with facts after the promotional specification sheet was faxed. That is the defining moment. You know, ultimately, they did enter into a sales contract and went on, you know, but the moment in time is when that promotional specification sheet is sent and what happened before.
Well, they say that K&S neither received or responded to any advertisement or promotion from Perfection with respect to a 1,000-ton press. So what are you talking about? That's what the your opposing counsel indicates, that there was no 1,000-ton press that they had, and they had to go out and search for one.
Well, that was a contested issue at trial, Your Honor. Just as a matter of background, they make two arguments. One, which they've backed away from, is that K&S initiated the contact with Perfection, and so that is a factor. Their second argument is that K&S engaged Perfection to go out and look for a press. Both of those factual arguments are undermined by the actual facts at trial. The relationship that existed, to the extent there was one, was that of arm's length buyer and seller. In 1996, they had their only other prior dealing. And that was an instance, and the record contains this evidence, is that K&S had bought a small piece of equipment called a roll former. So this is 4 years prior to this 1,000-ton press offer. They never bought anything else before or after that 1996 roll former. They, from time to time, would call Perfection and say, hey, what do you have of this type of equipment? What are you charging? But they never bought anything else. And that's not surprising because it is uncontested that Perfection was an industry leader. They were a market maker. So you would it wouldn't be unreasonable to call them and ask them, what do you have? What are you charging? So that's what existed up until that time. But significantly, they also would get catalogs that would have all of the inventory, all of the equipment that Perfection was selling.
Counsel, is it your position that if there are undisputed facts, that the question of whether or not someone is a member of the public is an issue of law for the court to determine as a matter of law?
I believe that you could have circumstances where the member of public issue becomes an issue of law, but there have to be facts that make it so. And in this case, they're arguing that there was an engagement between the parties.
I'm not making myself clear. It seems to me that on the issue of whether someone is a member of the public, you've got the law set out. And if they're undisputed facts, then arguably the court takes the undisputed facts and determines as a matter of law whether someone is a member of the public. If there are disputed facts, and we are sitting here listening to disputed facts, which is kind of unusual, as Justice Wilcox indicated, then it goes to the jury, and the jury makes factual determinations.
I would agree with that.
So what am I missing?
Well, what facts were in dispute for this jury? Because the judge sent it to the jury. So what facts about member of the public were in dispute?
There were facts in dispute, according to the Court of Appeals anyway, how it came down, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Who made the contact? What was said during the contact? That's what was in dispute.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Correct, Your Honor. And even this initiation of contact issue and why K&S called Perfection was a disputed issue of fact. There was facts in the record, testimony by Jason Broderick, who was the salesman for Perfection, where he testified that Tom Kluskin of K&S called me up and asked about a particular Danley press that was in our inventory. And when we have a press in inventory, we advertise it. So he called me and asked about a press that was being advertised in our inventory. Broderick says, I told Kluskin of K&S about that press in our inventory, and it turned out that it didn't quite fit what they wanted. So, and then it was at that point that Kluskin said, well, can you find me a press? And that exchange between Tom Kluskin of K&S and Jason Broderick of Perfection Machinery gave rise to disputing inferences to the extent of that an argument is being made that there was a contractual engagement between these parties. The testimony by Broderick was that If I don't have what the customer wants, I always offer to go look for it. I want to make a sale. That's what the salesman said. He said it was his standard operating procedure to offer to find equipment that a customer had expressed an interest in. And that makes sense. Perfection is in the business of selling equipment.
Does the record indicate whether K&S asked anybody else to look for a 1,010 press?
The record indicated, Tom Kluskin testified, that he had been looking around for other sources for the type of 1,000-ton press that he wanted and hadn't been able to find it.
I mean, did he ask any other company to keep their eyes peeled?
The record is silent on that, as to that particular question. But what is undisputed is that there was no agreement that either party had any duties to the other. When they hung up the phone, Perfection didn't have to go look for a press. They weren't duty-bound by contract or agreement to do that. And K&S, by the same token, was free to go and keep looking and buy a press from another company that may have one to be offered. And so if Perfection never called them back and said, we found a 1,000-ton press for you to consider, it wouldn't have mattered. If K&S had bought a press from another vendor in the interim, it wouldn't have mattered. The parties had no duties, no contract, no agreement between each other. All they were arm's length potential buyer and seller.
Would Perfection disagree with you on the proposition that K&S could have gone anywhere to look for, or gone to anyone else to look for a press?
Well, the record is silent on that, because there were no discussions between Tom Kluskin of K&S and Jason Broderick about an exclusive finder's fee or brokerage agreement. It was simply a circumstance where a seller says, hey, I'll keep my eyes out. I'll keep my eyes open. If I find it, I'll let you know. It was very informal. The examples you could see day to day. You go into a wine store, if you're a wine connoisseur, and say, I'd like to get this kind of wine. And the proprietor says, well, we don't have that here, but, you know, I'll keep my eyes open. It may come in, and I'll let you know if it comes in. That type of potential buyer and seller relationship, there's no duties, there's no boundaries, there's no responsibilities. And so, at a minimum, there was an issue of fact as to whether these parties had a sufficient relationship to take it out of the public, out of the member of public. And so the trial court submitted it to the jury for consideration, and the jury answered the question that, yes, K&S was a member of the public when that promotional specification sheet was sent.
Counselor, this kind of relationship is talked about as a particular relationship, which to me is kind of a odd term, but it's used over and over. If you would have us write this opinion to try to put some flesh on that term, how would you have us describe the type of relationship that is necessary to step outside of the public?
First of all, I don't know if you need to go there to decide this case, because I think that there was sufficient evidence simply for the court to let it go to the jury to be decided. But if this court wanted to further define this particular relationship, I, as I've indicated in my briefs, have advocated and would suggest a standard that defines it by what it is not. And what I would suggest is you define it by saying it is not certain legally cognizable relationships. Relationships that through our common law we've already defined, and there's case law that discusses them. Jury instructions could be formed to instruct a jury as to what these relationships are. And these relationships could be landlord-tenant, as was the example in the Cocker versus Meyer case, the 1911 case, or a landlord, which was a landlord-tenant case, or a contractual relationship, as was the case in Kalin versus Armstrong. You could think of other examples, such as shareholder common shareholders, joint venturers, a fiduciary relationship. These are all relationships where the parties have duties and responsibilities to each other. They've been defined in our law, and then if those are not examples of public relationships, we have narrowed the definition, and that may be helpful.
Thank you.
So what I would, again, just emphasize to the court is, in regard to this member of public issue, there were disputes. There was a dispute, number one, whether Kluskin called up because he was calling about a press that had been advertised and was in inventory at Perfection Machinery. And secondly, whether there was some type of contractual engagement relationship created. Was it a broker relationship? Was it an agent relationship? These are questions that were certainly disputed, and I would submit that the overwhelming evidence was that there wasn't any type of a formal binding contractual relationship with
Mr. Hanrahan. It's my understanding that on the second issue, having to do with whether there was sufficient evidence presented to support the finding on cause, that your opposing counsel is maintaining that the jury instruction was inadequate, that the jury instruction should have included information directly going to the idea of reliance. What is your response to that argument?
I have several responses, Your Honor. First and foremost, I would point the court out to the Court of Appeals decision at paragraph 39, footnote number 9. And it was at that point that the Court of Appeals discussed the jury instruction that was submitted by Perfection, or apparently submitted, at the trial court. And number one, and I'm quoting or referring to the footnote 9, Perfection itself didn't even request a reasonable or justifiable reliance standard. All they asked for, they asked the jury to be instructed, you must determine whether or not K&S relied on the statements in the proposal. Just relied. They didn't have justifiable or reasonable as an element. And then the footnote continues on and says, however, Perfection does not provide a record cite to show that it brought this proposed instruction to the attention of the circuit court during the instruction conference or objected to the standard instruction on causation that the court proposed to give because the standard instruction did not address reliance. Our own review of the record does not disclose that Perfection did either. And so I would submit that is the record, that they didn't submit this jury instruction that is referenced. They didn't object to the standard instruction that the trial court gave. So as Justice Radley has discussed, I believe that issue really, it's not framed to be raised here now before this court. And so in terms of that causation issue, I think that we simply have to look, how was the jury instructed? And based on the instruction that the jury was given, was there any credible evidence with which the verdict can be sustained? And on that point, I would, as I've indicated in my brief, five arguments were made by Perfection Machinery. First, they simply dismissed Tom Kluskin's testimony as self-serving. Tom Kluskin was up on the stand and was cross-examined for a lengthy period of time by very competent trial counsel. The jury had every opportunity to assess that man's credibility and his testimony about what he relied on, what he was thinking, and why he did things. And the jury answered the verdict question that K&S entered the transaction, was caused to enter the transaction because of the false specification sheet. And so I really think that, just simply calling it self-serving is meaningless, and you have to look at the fact that this man was vigorously cross-examined. Second, Perfection argues that the as-is clause excuses any reliance on the specification. And as I've indicated in my brief, there is a distinction between the condition of the press on one hand and the specifications on another. You can have a V8 engine with leaking gaskets. That's a condition, leaking gaskets. Whether or not that engine is actually a V8 or whether it's just a little four-cylinder engine, that's a specification. And the witnesses at trial testified that there is a difference between those, and the witnesses, in fact, Perfection's own witnesses testified that the as-is clause applies only to the condition of the press. Third, they argued that K&S relied on industrial rebuilding to determine whether this was a 1,000-ton press. Again, that was contested and actually refuted at trial by the facts. K&S never asked industrial rebuilding to determine the pressing capacity. They went industrial rebuilding, sent a person out to Michigan to look at the press to determine the condition. And there was actually two presses, and they looked at the condition of both and said one is in better condition, so you should buy that one. But there, the duty and the engagement between K&S and industrial was simply to look at the condition. That was the testimony. Third, they've argued that Perfection, or fourth, they've argued that industrial should have determined or discovered that the press was a 1,000-ton press. And they basically say, as the agent of K&S, K&S becomes responsible when industrial didn't discover this. And again, the facts were that just looking at the press by a press expert, you couldn't determine the pressing capacity. It was actually there was markings on the press that indicated it was a 1,000-ton press, and the sizing of the what's called the torque pack could be on a 1,000-ton or an 800-ton, depending on the speed of the press. And so just looking at it, you can't tell. And so, you know, the only expert testimony about press evaluating a press was by Rock Reitzman of Industrial Rebuilding and Don Schein, who is a press rebuilding expert called by K&S, and both of them said, you can't tell just by looking at it. So there was no evidence even that there was negligence.
Is there any necessity in the statute for Perfection to have known that it wasn't a 1,000-ton press?
No, Your Honor. Essentially, what the statute requires is that if you're a seller of a product and you're going to make a statement of fact about aspects of that product, you better know they're accurate. The statute teaches sellers, don't say something in an advertisement if you don't know it's accurate. Check it out. That's what the statute teaches. There's not an intent element to the statute. So you're right.
So there's it's sort of strict liability for mistake?
That is the standard that the legislature chose to establish in this. And so, yes, if you're a seller, you better know what you're talking about when you make representations, because then the only thing you'll have to fall back on is that it was not a material representation or it was an insignificant representation or fact. And you could have that where, for example, in this case, if the specification sheet said that it was a blue painted press and we buy it and it's a red press, I think that we would have, the buyer would have a hard time convincing a jury that the color of the press was what motivated us to buy the press. And so we'd lose the case on causation. But in regard to material elements of a product, the statute requires accuracy.
Well, what motivated you here was the fact it was a 1,000-pound press, 1,000-ton press. But it really wasn't. How would they determine that, they being your opposing counsel or the representative?
Right. Perfection Machinery, if they're going to make the representation of the specification in their promotional sheet, should have contacted the manufacturer, confirmed the information, and then they would be correct in putting it on a promotional specification sheet. That is ultimately, once K&S realized that this press couldn't make the part, they began the process of contacting the manufacturer and attempting to determine. And this was an old press, and they had to go into archives, but they were able to determine.
The record, what is the record with respect to any questions asked by K&S of the owner of the press before perfection? They never asked? Is this a...
The owner of the press was a company called Power Press Sales Incorporated in Wixon, Michigan. That's where the press was located. And the evidence in the record in terms of communications between K&S and Power Press Sales was that Tom Kluskin called Mr. Farnick, who was the owner of Power Press Sales, and asked him about the history of the press. Where had that press been installed and working? How long was it there? Those types of questions. And that was one of the things that Mr. Kluskin wanted to know in making a decision. The record is silent as to whether he asked him, do you know it's a 1,000-ton press? Because, again, Tom Kluskin's testimony was that when I sent the person from Industrial Rebuilding out to look at the condition of the press, I assumed and believed that it was a 1,000-ton press, so I didn't ask him to investigate the capacity. I assumed that that was true and believed that that was true.
Okay. K&S could have asked that Michigan owner and could have asked the original manufacturer, but I think you're arguing that the burden to ask those questions was on perfection, not on K&S. Why?
Because that's what the statute requires. The when you advertise a product and say to a potential buyer, here, this is what I'm offering to sell you, 100.18 puts the responsibility on the seller to make sure that the information about the product is accurate. It does change the old buyer beware common law, ancient Latin standard. and that was the reason why the statute was enacted, because the legislature must have come to the conclusion that that long-held common law standard of buyer beware was insufficient for our society, and that as a society, we wanted to put the responsibility on the seller who's out in the marketplace, who has and should know about the product they're selling, put the responsibility on them to be accurate, as opposed to putting it on the buyer to do all the work and attempt to see if the person's being truthful. And so I guess that is a legislative determination.
And I assume if the buyer knew that it was an 800-pound press and bought it anyway, that wouldn't be a material... seller would not have been a material inducement.
I think you're absolutely right, Judge. By analogy, you could look at the misrepresentation cases where the buyer knew of a defect in a home or whatever they're buying and went ahead and bought it anyway. And in that case, courts have held that they must not have relied upon. It was not a material inducement in going through with the transaction.
Now, suppose a Warner Brothers studio advertises a blue cloak that it represents, it will actually permit me to fly. and I buy it. I'm materially induced by this concept. It's just would be cheaper than United or Northwest or Midwest. Do I get a jury trial?
Your Honor, I believe you're referring to the example that Judge Fine gave in that Meslewski versus Rapkin case.
Exactly. 2006.
And, right.
Case.
And in that case, I think that Judge Fine was right in saying that is a circumstance that as a matter of law, a court could find such a representation was not a material inducement. And so even if you yourself got up and or said in an affidavit, well, I believe that I could fly when I bought it, a jury would need to assess your credibility and look at you saying that and come to a determination, and I believe they would probably disbelieve you.
I mean, that's exactly the example, and it's exactly the case I'm referring to. And the court went on there to say that reasonable reliance is not an element, but either as a matter of law or the jury can determine that, in fact, this purchaser did not, because he could not, or she could not have relied on it.
Right. Okay. And I think that's right. It gets to that cause question, and at some point it becomes ridiculous to say something, an absurd assertion would cause me to enter a transaction. So I believe you're right, Your Honor. So when, in summary, in regard to this member of public issue, I believe that there were contested facts arising out of the arguments made by Perfection in regard to who solicited who first, why. I believe that that is largely irrelevant, but to the extent it's considered, it's contested. And secondly, in regard to this argument that K&S engaged Perfection, I believe that was a definitely disputed issue. The jury was given a jury instruction that said if the parties, for example, enter a contract, then the buyer's not a member of the public. And what they're essentially asserting is that a contract relationship was created by this engagement, and the jury rejected that. And I think the judge was justified, the trial court judge was justified in submitting the question to the jury. Thank you. I see my time is done.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Siebold, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. The first point I'd like to make is I'm concerned about the assertion that there are a plethora of factual issues that required this issue of member of the public to go to the jury. And I would suggest that there are really no material issues of disputed fact that required the jury to decide the case. And I'd like to just simply read some testimony of the president of K&S, Mr. Kluskin, on cross-examination at trial. He's asked, now, when you called Perfection in May 2000, and by the way, I'm at page 54 of our appendix. It's page 77 of the record. Now, when you called Perfection in May 2000 about finding a 1,000-ton press, it wasn't because you had seen some newspaper ad, had you? No. Okay, nobody called you on the phone and was soliciting you to buy a press from Perfection, right? No. Nobody faxed you an unsolicited ad, correct? No. You called them, yes. And you called them because you had dealings with them before and knew them to be a dealer, yes. And you did buy a roll former from them, yes. And then, later, he's being asked about the discussion with Perfection's representative. And he says, the question is, and you told him, Mr. Broderick, you were looking for a 1,000-ton press, correct? Yes. And then a little bit later, I'm on page 57 of the appendix. And do you remember Mr. Broderick told you that he had one Danley 1,000-ton press kind of sitting in front of him at the moment? Do you recall? I don't recall that, no. And that's fine. It was 4 years ago, and I understand that. But in any event, Mr. Broderick didn't have the press you wanted, correct? Yes. And he told you that? Yes. And you didn't at that point say, well, that's okay, I'll look somewhere else. You asked Mr. Broderick if he'd look around and see if he could find one for you, didn't you? Yes. Okay, and he did, didn't he? Yes. There is an undisputed record, admissions by the president of K&S at trial that he specifically requested Perfection to go out and find a press when he knew that that Perfection did not have one in inventory.
Counsel, if I can ask you about that, I'm referring now to page 4 of Mr. Hammerhand's brief. He discusses the facts, and I think at issue you're arguing the relationship, and And I guess the question of at least arguable question of fact, is where do you begin the relationship? You seem to focus on when he solicited or asked him that, well, you don't have one, find it. But my understanding of the representations made in Mr. Hanrahan's brief is that initially there was an advertisement in a catalog about a 1,000-ton Danley press, and he refers to page one, record 99, page 160. In fact, Mr. Kleskin called to talk with you about a 1,000-ton Danley press with a 108-bed, correct? Answer, yes, we did discuss the Danley 108-bed, 1,000-ton press, that's correct. The question, but that's why he called you to ask about that? Answer, I believe so. And apparently there was the problem with that particular press is there were no cushions.
Right.
And so as I understand the facts, and correct me if I'm wrong, the initial communication is in response to a catalog advertisement, but that particular press wasn't the press that they could use because it didn't have the cushions. And then the conversation takes place, well, do you have another press? No, but if we find one, we'll let you know. And then that relationship develops. So I guess the question factually becomes, where does this relationship begin? Does it begin in the beginning or the middle or at what point?
First of all, with respect to the Danley press, the testimony that I just read, it makes it unequivocal that Mr. Kleskin was not calling in response to a particular ad that he saw or a particular catalog. Mr. Broderick, I think, assumed he was calling about the Danley press because that's the one that they had in stock, and it soon became clear that the Danley press wasn't appropriate. And I think the critical point is the other facts provide context, certainly. The past relationship provides context. But the point at which the particular relationship began was when Kleskin said to Mr. Broderick, can you find me a press? And Mr. Broderick said, I'll look for one. At that point, there was an agency relationship. He, Mr. Broderick, through Perfection, was acting as K&S's finder. And that was a very limited, particularized role that he undertook. And the subsequent conduct helps inform the understanding and relationship of the parties at that particular point in time, because as soon as Perfection came back and said, found a couple of potential presses, K&S took over. They grabbed the ball and they ran with it. They talked to the owner. They took responsibility to get to contact the manufacturer, which they then assigned to their expert industrial building, who in fact failed to contact Clearing. And Mr. Kleskin admitted at trial that if Clearing would have been contacted, he would have found out the true nature of the press. But he assigned that responsibility to industrial engineering, and industrial engineering dropped the ball. And then industrial engineering, and they looked at the presses, and they made a specific recommendation about this specific piece to K&S. So I think the point in time that the relationship occurred is right when there was the request and the agreement to go look. But the rest provides the context of what the relationship was at that point in time. I see my time is up. Could I
just... Time is up, counsel. Just summarize in one quick sentence, please.
Sure. Your Honors, I believe that really the purpose of this statute is to protect consumers, vulnerable consumers, as it said in Bond v. Halbrick. And what we had here was two very sophisticated parties who engaged in a particularized relationship to find a press, and the very sophisticated K&S Manufacturing undertook to do its own investigation, made a decision to buy completely separate from Perfection Machinery, and then Perfection Machinery simply facilitated that transaction. And I would submit to the justices that the statute was not intended to protect that kind of malfeasance on the part of K&S. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Hanrahan. Thank you, Mr. Seabold, for your arguments today on a very interesting statute, 100.18. The court is now adjourned for the December oral argument sitting. This concludes 05-AP-2148 K&S Tool and Die Corp. versus Perfection Machinery. The court will meet in closed session at 11:20, and Justice Prosser will be out shortly to speak with the class. We are adjourned.